Chief Justice. May it please the court.
I'm Giancarlo Canaparo.
I'm Zach Smith.
And welcome to SCOTUS 101, where we break down what's happening at the Supreme Court, what the justices are up to,
and other things related to our favorite branch of government.
Welcome back to SCOTUS 101.
Welcome back. GC, can you believe the court is done with oral arguments for the term?
No, and I mean, it's gone by fast, and yet we're only sort of just commencing in another way.
Well, I think all of us know it's time to buckle up because the opinions will start coming out fast and furiously over the next couple of weeks. But before we turn to the oral arguments and other happenings at the court, GC, what's happening on the orders front this week?
Sure. Just one order to note. The court granted certiorari in a case that will decide whether the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms has the authority to regulate weapon kits from which people can assemble firearms. The question turns on whether these unassembled kits count as firearms or frames or receivers under the relevant act.
Interesting. How about oral argument?
Sure. I'll start with Grants Pass versus Johnson. That case will decide whether a generally applicable law against camping in a city is cruel and unusual punishment to homeless people in violation of the Eighth Amendment. The Ninth Circuit held that it is, and accordingly prevented Western cities, particularly Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Seattle, from doing much about their tent city problems. You would hardly know it from oral arguments, which were overwhelmingly about policy, but the question is really, what is the original meaning of the Eighth Amendment, and to what extent, if any, does it bar states from imposing small fines against camping in a general manner? To the extent that the oral arguments were on law, not policy, the debate focused on two cases, Robinson versus California and Powell versus Texas. In Robinson, the court held that a state cannot make it a crime to be a drug addict. And in the second, it said that states can, however, make it a crime to be drunk in public. The dividing line between those two cases being that a law cannot criminalize a mere state of being, but that it can criminalize a choice derived from that state of being. So much of the debate was over whether these camping bans criminalize the state of being homeless or the choice to camp in public. The justices seem to be split along party lines on that one.
Yeah, you know, this was actually a fascinating oral argument in a lot of ways, GC, because you had the advocate for Grants Pass arguing. You had the advocate for the homeless individuals arguing as well. And then you also had the United States weighing in favor of those challenging the Grants Pass ordinance and others like it. And so it certainly was a very contentious argument in some cases. There was a question about how do you define homelessness, a question about how would the policy that those challenging this ordinance, how would that play out on the ground? Justice Alito really had a phenomenal series of questions to the advocate, asking how police officers would be expected to enforce the policy they were promoting. And so I think we'll all be waiting and watching to see what happens in this case, but it'll certainly be very consequential nonetheless.
Absolutely.
All right. Next up is Starbucks versus National Labor Relations Board. This case will decide what standard applies when the National Labor Relations Board tries to get an injunction against a company during the course of a dispute over unionization efforts. Until recently, courts used a four-part test based on traditional principles of equity, but the NLRB has successfully convinced lower courts to use a new and much more lenient standard. The justices seem largely in agreement that the traditional four-part test should remain, which means that the NLRB will get no special treatment, but instead will be bound by the traditional equity considerations just like anyone else. And that brings us to the final and probably the most consequential oral argument the court heard this week involving Trump versus United States. Now, you may recall we went into the details of this case several weeks ago with Professor John Yu when he joined us for the show. So we won't rehash many of the details here, but it is worth noting that the oral arguments in this case were a marathon affair going almost 3 hours. And of course, many of the issues that Professor Yu flagged during our interview did in fact come up, with many of the justices recognizing that the rule they establish will have far-reaching implications beyond Donald Trump and will potentially impact the presidency for years to come. Justice Neil Gorsuch noted at oral argument that the court would be, quote, writing a rule for the ages. Now, what was interesting about this argument as well is that it seemed to go much more favorably for Donald Trump than many commentators initially suspected. In fact, it only seemed like the three liberal justices were skeptical of immunity writ large. The other justices seem to be more open to some type of immunity applying to official actions of presidents that would bar criminal prosecution for those actions. One of the interesting debates is whether the actions that Donald Trump was alleged to have taken in this case, whether they were official acts or whether they were personal acts, and that may depend on the outcome of the case. And so one potential outcome that could happen as a result of this is that the court could send the case back to the lower federal courts and first ask them to determine whether Trump's actions in this case amounted to official or private acts, or whether they would be official acts, where the immunity question would then kick in and come to the forefront. In an interesting note on the style of the argument, former Missouri Solicitor General John Sauer was representing Donald Trump. Of course, Michael Dreeben, formerly of the Solicitor General's office, was in private practice and is now representing the special counsel in this case, appeared on opposite sides. But one thing that I thought was very interesting is that typically the petitioner case goes first, the other side presents their case, and then the petitioner typically gets a very short amount of time to offer a rebuttal. In this case, John Sauer, he waived his rebuttal, which is highly unusual at the Supreme Court and is maybe an indication that John thought the argument went better than many had expected. But I think we'll get a decision in this case certainly early this summer, which will then tee up the remaining proceedings, if any, that will take place.
Fascinating.
And as I mentioned, Professor John Yu did join us several weeks ago to discuss the intricacies of this case against Donald Trump and several of the other Trump-related cases. And so if you missed that interview, you can find it at SCOTUS 101 and listen to that and all of our other previous interviews as well. Now, for this week's interview, I have a fascinating conversation with Professor Hadley Arkus about natural law and his new book discussing the role that natural law should play in our legal system. Stay tuned for that interview right after this.
Five days a week, two episode formats, one mission: to deliver the news you care about and analysis on the biggest issues facing America. The Daily Signal podcast brings you two episodes every day in the same podcast feed. Each morning, catch interviews with policymakers, leading experts, and conservative activists as we discuss some of the greatest challenges facing our country and offer solutions for a brighter future. And every weekday at 5 p.m., we bring you the top news of the day. These are the headlines you care about. Subscribe to the Daily Signal podcast wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss out on our morning interviews or evening news.
Well, I'm pleased to be joined today by Professor Hadley Arkus. His new book, Mere Natural Law, Originalism and the Anchoring Truths of the Constitution, was recently released. Professor Arkus, thanks for joining the show.
Oh, thanks for inviting me in, Zach.
Of course, very happy to have you, and I'm very much looking forward to our conversation today.
Now, what can I tell you about natural law?
Well, that is the topic of our conversation, and I'll tell you what, why don't we dive right into it? What is natural law?
What is natural law? As Aquinas and Kant would tell us, the natural law is the law that tells us why we have laws and why we are justified in having positive laws, those laws that are enacted. And so let's say you see those signs saying 65 mph, 35 miles per hour. But Kant would say, but before you have something like that, you have an underlying natural law that tells you why you'd be justified in having regulations that restrain the freedom of people to drive at speeds that put innocent life at hazard. And the task, as ever, is to make a transition between the underlying principle of the natural law converted into regulations, positive law, that bear more precisely on the circumstances and terrain before us. Now, in that sense, the natural law underlies everything we do. And in fact, it tells us who is it who makes the positive law? What are the kinds of institutions that will produce the positive law we respect? So the classic understanding was, what is a constitution? What do you do with the Constitution? The purpose of the Constitution is to create the kind of structure that will give us a practice or pattern of activity that's consistent with the underlying character or the principles of the character of that regime we're trying to put in place. The first one didn't work. We had to go to something else. But, you know, I remember once hearing Professor Amy Comey Barrett in a program was on, somebody asking, well, why do you respect the positive law? What makes the positive law in America different from the positive law in Stalin's Russia? I said, well, because the positive law here is made in institutions sprung from the principle that the only rightful government over human beings is one that draws its powers from the consent of the government. It's a government of free elections. Now, the principles that establish that, what is the rightful form of governance, they have to be in place before you understand in the first place who can make the positive law. So the natural law underlies everything, not only underlies legislature, but underlies every judgment the judges make.
So in your view, then, what role should natural law play when judges are interpreting the Constitution or other statutes?
Oh, that's like asking what role should language play?
Well, what role should it play?
Well, it's like, say, I remember somebody saying once, a bit proud of it, the judges didn't say much about natural law in those early days. And my friend Dan Robbins said, yeah, they didn't say nothing about the alphabet either. It's just, it underlies everything they do. You know, it's like John Marshall once saying, apologizing to his readers for spending so much time demonstrating what should stand in the class of an axiom. And as he understood that all literate readers knew that before he could carry out a demonstration, people had to grasp certain things as per se no, or true themselves, like the law of contradiction. Two contradictory propositions, you know, cannot both be true. And if you didn't grasp that, there was no way to explain it to you in the form of a demonstration. You had to know that before you stepped into the demonstration. Now, the critical point is why people like Marshall and Alexander Hamilton kept doing that. They kept tracing their judgments back to those anchoring axioms that had to be in place before they can explain the grounds of their judgments. For judges to ask, what role does natural law play? Yeah, it's like it's like asking, what role should syntax play in the work of my day? There's no getting, it underlies everything you claim you're doing, and it runs through everything you claim you're doing. It also tells us in the first place, what is a law? What are the properties of a law? I want to try that one out for a moment, Zach. Let's say you could do this by just getting the natural reaction to this case. About 40 years ago, I did a book called Philosopher in the City, and I recorded this X-rated show I saw on Capitol Hill with Dr. Judith Denzengerber giving a presentation. She dealt with child abuse, and she's giving a presentation which showing the results of gonorrhea in the throat of a 9-year-old girl and an 18-year-old girl. Now, let's say we confront people that. We have confront the man who does that. What's the sensible response? We come to him, we say, gee, we'll give you a tax incentive if you'll stop doing that. We'll give you a Netflix account. We'll make some kind of deal with you. Now, when you give this to people, the natural reaction is, no, you don't make a deal with somebody. The natural reaction is to respond in the voice of a command. Stop. Stop doing. Who should stop? First of all, you're saying stop. It means you're making a moral judgment. You're saying you're in the presence of something you ought not do. And then you say, who ought not do it? This guy who's doing it to those girls? Or anyone who does it? In other words, you draw upon the logic of a moral judgment. We move away from statements of merely personal taste and preference. We speak about things that are generally or universally good or bad, right or wrong. Once you put those in place, that's what we mean by a law. That's the classic connection, classic understanding between the logic of morals and the logic of law. Once you come to the recognition that anything like any act like this stands in the class of a wrong, something you forbid, wrong enough to forbid, You would forbid it to anyone who does it with a universal sense of a moral proposition. For anyone who does that is engaged in wrongdoing. And there you have that tells you what a law is. It stems from a moral judgment about the kinds of things that are so wrong that we'd forbid it to whom? To anyone who comes within the reach of our laws. Well, that is the classic connection. It's at work in all the things we do. There's no way to get around it. And so it's an idle question to ask, when do the judges employ natural law? They're using it every day.
Well, now, not everyone agrees with your view, Professor Arkes. But I thought I would read maybe a passage from someone I know you know very well and have debated many times in the past, now deceased Judge Robert Bork. He famously disagreed about the role that natural law should play. And so if it's okay with you, I thought I would read a quote to you from a March 1992 essay he wrote in First Things, where he was responding to one of your earlier books on natural law, and then get your reaction to this quote. In his First Things essay from 1992, Robert Bork said, quote, "Arkes contends that moral reasoning not only illuminates the proper reach of existing constitutional principles, but may properly be employed by judges to create new constitutional principles. A natural law judge would make positive laws out of his own perception of universal moral judgments." Now, Bork went on to say that, quote, "it seems impossible to live any sort of decent life without ideas about moral truth, just as it seems a corruption of the judge's function to confuse those ideas with the law to be applied." Now, in your view, where did Judge Bork go wrong in that statement?
He assumes that the natural law is something hovering in the sky. He assumes that if you break away from the text, you're involving only your own perceptions. That became a famous line with him, that any judge who moves away from the text is simply looking inside himself, as though there are no moral truths that are not contained in the text. The founders would find that just remarkable. They're persistently appealing to those things, to those anchoring truths. But what Bork again... He has this thing that among many judges, they think of natural law, some hovering thing in the sky, something woolly and thought, not rather than seeing it as the ground of our most practical judgments. And it starts with something that any ordinary man understands. Take both Thomas Reed and Immanuel Kant's understanding of the very first law principle of moral judgment. It's grasped by the ordinary man of us as soon as you put this question to him. If he's told that Jones, accused of a serious crime, was in intensive care following surgery at the time the crime was committed, would anyone doubt what the ordinary man would say? He's going, why is he being prosecuted? He wasn't born yet. Why is he being prosecuted? Does the ordinary man grasp readily what Kant and Reed taught? First, that it makes no sense to cast judgments of praise or blame on people for acts they were powerless to do. So say we don't hold people blameworthy or responsible for acts they were powerless to effect. That simple proposition runs through our laws as we trace them out. Okay, it's not made explicit. Neither is the principle of innocent till proven guilty, yet everybody thinks that is part of the Constitution. And what Bork did not recognize, those, what we would call, those precepts of common sense that are the anchor of the natural law, these precepts of common sense that the ordinary man not only knows, but has to know in getting on with the business of life. So as Reed would say, before the ordinary man would banter with David Hume about the meaning of causation, he knew his own active powers to cause his own acts to happen. That proposition, we don't hold people blameworthy for acts they were powerless to effect. It runs through our laws. It was not made explicit, but it's recognized here. And the implications are drawn all the way through. People should be held accountable only for what they do. If we respect the difference between innocence and guilt, We think we are obliged to use the most demanding methods of testing the evidence for wrongdoing rather than having people run over hot coals or out on a mob. And as you trace, again, those principles all the way down, you finally arrive at something like this, that anyone accused of a crime should have access to the witness against him for the sake of testing their validity and getting a verdict that is substantively accurate in discriminating between innocence and guilt. In other words, if you follow this out, you find that that right to confront witnesses is simply implicit in the very logic of moral. It would be there even if there were no constitution. Just as John Quincy Adams told us that that right to petition the government, it would be there even if it hadn't been mentioned in the First Amendment. It would be there even if there were no First Amendment. It would be there even if there were no constitution. It's now, these things, sometimes they're just discovered as people go along. Using the due process clause, they confront things they never expected to find. And suddenly these things come. Of course, proved innocent to proving. Of course, you should be have the right to confront witnesses against you. They arise from the very logic of law. Bob is a sweet man, but he had a notion of moral reasoning, something high in the sky and intensely personal. He didn't have the sense that when we were speaking of these moral truths, we were moving beyond statements of merely personal taste or private judgment, and speaking about the things that are more generally universally right or wrong, and the angle for it becomes those principles of common sense that the ordinary man not only knows, but cannot deny without falling into gibberish.
Well, I guess I would have, I have two follow-up questions for you then, based on Judge Bork's view and your view. Could someone agree that natural law and the moral truths that accompany it are important considerations, but that those are considerations more appropriate for a legislator to make than for a judge to make?
And what principle would he invoke to notice? Let's say I say, it is an anchoring truth, a necessary truth, that we don't hold people blameworthy or responsible for acts they were powerless to effect. Why would that principle not be as accessible to a judge as to a legislator? Or what principle would tell us why that proposition is confined to one segment rather than the other? I'm curious as to how you deal with that.
Well, I think my understanding, I think Judge Bork's response would be that in our system of government, it's the people's elected representatives that often make many of the deepest moral judgments of our day.
That doesn't meet my question. Here is an anchoring principle. It is absolutely true. Hamilton talked about those primary truths are first principles. Now, could you tell me why that kind of truth would be inadmissible to be recognized either by a legislator or an executive? To say that it's in our system of government does not really explain that point. It doesn't really address it. So you can say, well, why do you think that in the system of government you have in mind a necessary truth which holds in all places, everywhere in the world, somehow is not part of the work of the legislator or not part of the work of the... How do you get that confining principle?
But if the legislature provides for X, would a judge be free to decide that Y should apply instead?
What if he decides that? What if they decide that people may be held responsible for X they were powerless to commit? What if they decide that take Rehnquist's line, people can be people who are resident aliens can be denied benefits on the conditions they were powerless to control? I mean, are you saying that there's no ground in which one could call into question what a legislature has done? I mean, that's one of the purposes of judicial review, as Webster said. It must be more a test than that something's been passed. So you're not quibbling that out. You're not quibbling that it's somehow wrong.
Well, I think the as I read Judge Bork's statement, as I understand some who question the role of natural law, their question is, how does your theory of the role of natural law and the role it should play with judges moving beyond the text of the Constitution, how does your theory of that differ from the living constitutionalism that so many on the left have used to impose their own moral preferences through judicial decisions?
Zach, apparently you didn't get what I said. I'm not engaging theories. To say that people may not be held responsible for acts they were powerless to effect is not a theory. It's not a theory any more than two contradictory propositions both cannot be true. Do you have me on that point? If there are truths of that kind, they're not merely theories. So where are we with this? I mean, to the extent that what Bork was missing, probably missing, was that the magical is something hovering in the air instead of something that really forms the ground, the anchoring grounds of our practical judgments. Take that from another angle then, Zach.
Okay. Well, all right, setting aside, I guess, broadly speaking, how does your view of natural law, if someone were to say you're really just imposing your own living constitutionalist ideas under the guise of natural law, how would you respond to that?
First principle of law, moral judgment. We don't hold people blameworthy or responsible for the acts they were promised to effect. Is that really my personal view? Does it do any justice for anyone to write that off as my personal view, Zach? If I'm dealing with anchoring truths, they can't be merely my personal view. The problem with the living constitution is that they reject any kind of moral truth as the basis of the law. They stand for a jurisprudence that involves the liberation of human beings from any kind of fixed moral truths, especially the truths involving the nature of sex and the way we are constituted as human beings. Well, there's quite a radical difference. Both sides, left and right, both have found themselves dismissing the natural law. The left, because they reject moral truths at all. The right turns and say, well, there may be moral truths, but it's a matter, you know, it's a sentiment. It has something in the air. Yeah, it's something upstanding and high-minded, but really we're not really clear that people really have access to these things to our reason. That it's a kind of a soft relativism that the right has engaged in for many years. They want to show public piety by saying that, yeah, we respect more, I believe in moral truths. But when it comes to it, there's really a kind of a holding back to recognize that there is a the reason I'm going, the book is called Mere Natural Law. I think you were asking me about mere natural law. And the very point of the book, Zach, is say this is not a matter of theory. It's not a matter of theory. Now, my friend, late friend Dan Robbins wrote 18 books, said he wanted on his tombstone, he died without a theory. And he was really referring to Thomas Reed saying, again, let me repeat my line, those axioms of common sense that an ordinary man have to know before they can start trafficking in theories. The purpose of my books is, and you could take this as a contrast to anything Bob wrote. And I think Bob would actually be with me on many things I argue in the book. I'm trying to point out to people that against this notion that the natural law is something foggy, hovering in the sky, we're trying to record people that the natural law finds its ground in those maxims of common sense that are not only true, but necessarily true, true of necessity. Like, we don't hold people blameworthy for acts they were powerless to effect. And when we build a system of law, as the American founders understood, their version, what they understood as natural law, was based precisely on those precepts of common sense, which is why, as you know, Jefferson said, you could give the same problem to a plowman and a professor, a moral problem, and the plowman is apt to get it right because he won't be distracted by these artificial rules. Call them theories. So what I'm offering, you give me examples to point out again. What I'm offering here is really a counter to so-called theories of natural law. It's something quite different. It's offered as something quite different. Well, people just have to read it and see whether it persuades them. And if they understand, okay, and we're free to read Bob and everything else. And I actually think that Bob would be with me many points away in this new book.
Excellent. Now, I know you talked about you wanted to move away from theories, move into what the common man would understand. Is that what led you to write your latest book, Mere Natural Law? Or what was kind of the motivating purpose for writing this book and putting forward your ideas on natural law and the role it plays?
I've been at this for a long time. I wrote a book years ago called First Things, a matter of moral truths and how we may know them. From that sprung other things. I wrote a book called Beyond the Constitution, which I sought to show how judges persistently, and statesmen like Lincoln, persistently have to go beyond the text of the Constitution in order to explain the ground of their judgment. They have to reach back to those principles that were before the Constitution. So Felix Frankfurt would say that, well, the Fifth Amendment says we may not hold people, may not make people testify against themselves in any criminal matter. He says, where is the accent to be placed? Is it against himself? Oh, if we give him immunity, can we compel him to testify against his friends in the Communist Party? There's a long record of this is done all the time. If you're up to one of the most elegant examples of this, was given to us by Marshall. Do you have 1 minute on a critical case? Do you have 1 minute on this? The most marvelous. James Wilson, Alfred Ellsworth, did not want to put anything in the text about the ex post facto laws, one of the most deepest principles of the law. You know, you don't make something criminal after that was not legally wrong when it was done. They didn't want to even put this in the text. And Marshall later gave us the most elegant argument on how the argument would be more compelling if you assumed it wasn't in the text. So he has this case of Fletcher versus Peck, this great old case. You have a legislature with some scandal giving out a grant, and the next legislature tries to rescind the grant. But many innocent buyers have bought the property. So this comes to the Supreme Court, and they could settle it by simply saying, well, you've undone the original contract. This is a law impairing the obligation of contracts. Article 1, Section 10, right? But instead of doing that, Marshall does something far more elegant. He shows how the contracts clause could be drawn deductively with the force of a syllogism from that deeper principle in ex post facto laws. And when he does it, he comes out with this just striking, credible observation. He says, Georgia is a great state. It's part of the American Union. But even if Georgia were a separate state, outside the Union, outside the Constitution, outside Article 1, Section 10, this law would still be wrong because its wrongness is rooted in a proposition that does not depend at all for its validity on being mentioned anywhere in the text. He showed us how to do it. In fact, in the argument over Obamacare, Greg Katz has pointed out Marshall saying in the Dartmouth College case, to force upon people a contract they do not want, say making them buy medical insurance, to force upon them a contract they do not want could be as wrong as impairing the obligation of a contract they had willingly made. And later, Justice Story would say that principle would be true even if it weren't in the Constitution. So my point, Zach, is this. The people who, as Jonathan Deneb said about the framers, they never thought it was necessary to put everything they know into that text of the Constitution. They assumed many of these things people readily understood, and they could appeal to them. And they gave us a splendid record, Hamilton, Madison, Marshall, on how to do it persistently, moving beyond the text before them for the sake of explaining the text, you see. So there's nothing novel here. It's just it's a matter of looking again and looking more closely at the reasoning that we've sort of failed to notice and recognizing how a very remarkable cluster of men just had this knack of tracing their judgments back to those anchoring axioms that were there before the text, and as they understood, would be there even if there were no Constitution.
Now, one of the things you mention in the book, and I've heard you talk about it elsewhere as well, is you've said that originalism is not enough. Could you unpack that for us?
Yeah, precisely for that, because it cuts off the teaching of the Constitution from the moral ground of the Constitution, as the founders understood. Just what I've just told you before. Look how Marshall did it. He shows you we could, even if ex post facto clause wasn't in the Constitution, you know, it's there and it could be invoked because it's a deep principle that would have to be there in any regime of law. Look, I had the great fortune of being a teacher of the American family. I could spend my time to have the sublime experience of teaching the writings of Wilson, Hamilton, Marshall, because after all, if you want to understand the Constitution, who better to look to than the people who could give the most luminous account of it? I'm a teacher of the American founding. But it is strange to teach that the Constitution and the founding utterly detached from those anchoring axioms that the founders understood, that they drew upon in framing the Constitution. The Constitution was not the source of their moral understanding. So it gives us a kind of crabbed positivism to be afraid of moving outside. People are way afraid because they thought that these judges in the 50s and 60s invented new rights. And the problem, they weren't in the Constitution. Well, if they think that was a serious mistake, the response was, show what was specious about the reasoning. How do you get to a right to abortion? How do you take the Liberty Clause and from that extract some kind of right to sodomy or same-sex marriage? The problem will not be found simply by removing the clause. So the conservative line on abortion was, well, abortion is not in the text, so we cannot, judges can't proclaim any rights not in the text. But marriage wasn't in the text. So the court struck down those laws that barred interracial marriage in 1967. And as Jerry Bradley's point out, the federal government had ample reason to be making abortion its business for many years, dealing with abortion in military hospitals, diplomatic outposts abroad, dealing with abortion in the territories, the District of Columbia. It's just a false and a kind of mechanistic way of approaching a serious question by saying, duh, it's not in the Constitution. We have no means of reasoning about it.
Well, Professor Arcus, I have a final question we ask all of our guests here on SCOTUS 101. If you could have a conversation with any justice, living or dead, who would it be and what would you talk about?
Well, it would have to be James Wilson, after whom one of the premier minds among the American founders, after whom we named our own institute. James Wilson, the writings of Thomas Reed and Common Sense, the Scottish Enlightenment, ran through his brilliant lectures on law. And he invokes Thomas Reed in the opening lines of that first case that actually had a printed out version with seriatim opinions, Chisholm versus Georgia in 1793, where he says, we're at the beginning of the American law. We don't have a distinct American precedence under this Constitution. We have to go back then to the principles of general jurisprudence. But then even before that, we have to go back to the writings of Thomas Reed on the principles of common sense, standing against that moral relativism that prevailed in Europe around the time he wrote. So he was invoking Thomas Reed to say, we begin this Constitution committed to the natural rights of human. That was why we have this Constitution, as he said, not to invent new rights, but to secure and enlarge those rights we had already by nature. And we invoke Thomas Reed to remind us of that is indeed that this defense of this Constitution and natural rights must begin by rejecting moral relativism in all its forms. There couldn't have been a better beginning. And he's the premier figure.
Well, Professor Arcus, this has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show today. We'd love to have you back again in the future. And I hope everyone will read your book.
Zach, you were great. Those those questions were really good.
Well, I appreciate it.
And I hope we'll do it again. I got to get you on my show. Okay.
Well, I'd love to do it. And I look forward to staying in touch. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much.
And that brings us to trivia. Zach, are you ready?
As ready as I'll ever be, GC.
All right. So with Eighth Amendment on the docket in Grants Pass, I thought let's do some Eighth Amendment trivia.
I think that sounds like cruel and unusual punishment to me, GC. I think we should ban it and let's call it a day right now.
I think we should ban that joke.
I'm sure many people would agree with you, but there it is. All right, let's get to it.
All right, number one. Under Supreme Court precedent, the death penalty is available, but it must be proportional to the crime and to the defendant's moral culpability. Can you name two types of cases where the court has forbidden the use of the death penalty?
And I'm assuming in two types of cases, you mean individuals accused of certain crimes. Well, a couple have come to mind. Obviously, in Kennedy versus Louisiana, the Supreme Court said that states were not allowed to execute those convicted of child sex offenses. Juvenile offenders are also not eligible to receive the death penalty under Roper versus Simmons. And then, of course, those who suffer from mental disabilities cannot receive the death penalty as well, according to Atkins versus Virginia. And largely, you know, this is an interesting debate. Largely, the Supreme Court has said that executions for non-capital offenses cannot take place. And yet, there are certain categories of crimes, crimes against the state, like espionage, for instance, where the court has not explicitly said that those types of cases are not impermissible. And I will mention one other thing, if I can, quickly, GC. You mentioned in your question that the death penalty is available, but it must be proportional to the crime and the offender and other moral culpability issues. That's actually a somewhat contentious point. Really, the only area in sentencing where the court has recognized any type of proportionality requirement under the cruel and unusual punishments clause is in the death penalty context. For most other sentences, the court has said that really a proportionality principle does not apply. And in fact, some of the justices, particularly Justice Antonin Scalia, push back against the idea that the cruel and unusual punishments clause itself contained a proportionality requirement, saying that it wasn't found in the text. And it's clear from the excessive fines clause and other provisions of the Constitution that the founders knew how to include that proportionality component if they wanted to, but that they did not include it in the cruel and unusual punishments clause itself.
Wow, it's almost like you used to be a criminal lawyer.
who knew? Who knew? Maybe I picked up something along the way.
Wow, I was really not prepared for you to just hit it out of the park with trivia. You've lulled me into a false sense of security over all these episodes.
don't get used to it. Well, and to be perfectly candid, this is an issue I've been looking at somewhat, particularly in light of the Kennedy versus Louisiana decision that prohibits execution for those convicted of certain child sex offenses, because Florida, Idaho, and some other states have either passed or are considering passing legislation that would tee up a direct challenge to those laws, to that decision, to Kennedy versus Louisiana. And I think that is a good thing because the Supreme Court's death penalty jurisprudence needs to be revisited and particularly more aligned with an originalist understanding of the Eighth Amendment's cruel and unusual punishments clause.
Well, you are obviously an expert, so I'm sure you're right.
always trust but verify what I say, but I think because I just looked at this not that long ago, I think this is generally accurate.
All right, well, question number two, I'm sure that you won't have a hard time with this one either. What sort of means for carrying out the death penalty are prohibited?
Well, basically, the court has said you can't intend to inflict unnecessary suffering or pain or humiliation in carrying out the process of execution. And so there is, of course, a debate about what methods of execution are permissible. I think if you go back to the founding, you know, hanging was the default method of execution. You also had firing squads and some other methods as well. But of course, today, most methods of execution challenges come about in the context of lethal injection.
Of course, absolutely correct. Number three, how many states forbid the death penalty as a matter of state law?
Well, I would have to look. I haven't looked in a little while, but it's somewhere north of 20, a little more than 20, and that number can vary a little bit. And some states prohibit it in their constitution. Some states prohibit it statutorily. Some state Supreme Courts have issued rulings that effectively nullify the death penalty in states, but a little bit north of 20. And I believe the District of Columbia, ironically, even though the death penalty is appropriate and allowed under federal law, I believe the District of Columbia itself does not allow their penal code does not allow for the death penalty.
That is correct. The District of Columbia and 23, to be specific, other states. Mm. So well done. Recently, question number four, Alabama executed a convicted murderer, Kenneth Smith, by a very unusual means. What was the means?
Yeah, this was a very controversial case in some sense, because instead of using lethal injection, I believe Alabama used nitrogen gas, essentially, to execute him.
Yeah, that's correct. The Supreme Court was asked to intervene at the last minute, but refused, and no justices dissented from the decision. All right, final question. Capital punishment is not the only Eighth Amendment issue. The amendment also forbids excessive fines. The excessive fines clause was only very recently incorporated against the states. When was it and in what case?
I believe it was a Timms versus Indiana, which I think was back in 2019.
Correct. Very well done. Mm. In that case, police confiscated Mr. Timms's $42,000 truck after finding that he used it to sell about $225 worth of drugs. He paid his fines, did his time, but the state kept his car. After the Supreme Court held that Timms could sue the state under the Eighth Amendment, the state courts held that the forfeiture was indeed an excessive fine. And no surprise, that was litigated by our friends at the Institute for Justice.
Mm, very interesting. You know, it's crazy. Time flies because it seems like that case was just in front of the court yesterday, but it's already been all the way back in 2019.
True enough. Well, for the record, I don't enjoy trivia when you knock it out of the park. That might make me petty, but such is what, such is life.
Well, I take it back, GC. This was not cruel and unusual today. I think we should have more trivia along these lines.
Well, it'll be much harder next time.
All right. Fair enough. Fair enough. And I'll get back to my usual slapdash approach to answering trivia. Well, that's all we have for today. Thank you to everyone for listening to SCOTUS 101. Please be sure to subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And as always, we'd appreciate if you left us a 5-star rating.
You can follow us on X at SCOTUS101 and email us at SCOTUS101@heritage.org with your questions, comments, or ideas for future shows.
You've been listening to SCOTUS 101, brought to you by more than 500,000 members of the Heritage Foundation. Executive produced by Giancarlo Canaparo and Zach Smith. Sound designed by Lauren Evans, Mark Guiney, and John Popp. For more information, visit heritage.org.